Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are. My name is Mushiri Nyaga from the Local Development Research Institute. Thank you for joining us or tuning into this Twitter space on data and access to justice. The Local Development Research Institute is part of the Data for Development Network, a global collaborative of institutions working around the issue of data for development. I am joined today on this Twitter space by Amy Yongeso. Amy works for Namati. She's a senior global network officer. She's based in Nairobi, Kenya, right around the corner from me. Only today I am across the country. But Amy, welcome. Karibu.
Thank you so much, Mushiri. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is Namati? What does it do? What do you do?
I'll try and give you a very short but very interesting version of what we do as Namati. I personally find that the work we do interesting. It could be a biased opinion, but as Namati, what we do is we work with communities and we put the power of the law in people's hands. So what we believe in is democratizing the law and having the most, you know, democratic and accessible form of the law in people's hands. And how we do this is we are guided by a certain ideology and methodology around legal empowerment. So it's called no law, use law, shape law. So I'll be a bit more specific. What guides us, we feel that if communities are able to follow the law, let's say they have a justice problem. And so then we sit together with the communities and we try to understand the problem. And then we try and analyze what does the law say about this, if there's a law at all. And if the law is, you know, very good and responsive to this justice problem, then we work with the communities to get a solution. So that is that knowing the law, using the law, and the solution would be shaping the law. But in the process, let's say we encounter a problem together with communities or populations that are affected by a certain injustice, and there's no law that exists, or perhaps the law that exists is bad, then there's still an opportunity to shape the law in terms of, you know, reforming that particular bad law or having in place a law that is responsive to justice needs. So that's what guides us in our work. And we believe that this is a sustainable way of ensuring, you know, people are able to access justice. And more specifically, what I do is then I work on this beautiful continent of ours and I support organizations to really use this legal empowerment methodology to ensure that even the person at the grassroots level are able to understand what this law is and how it impacts their lives.
And I suspect that what you've provided is a very, very accurate picture of what Namati does. And really, it really does sound like you're right in the middle of the whole process of social transformation, changing the world to become a better place for everybody.
I think we try. One of the most challenging things about the work that we do is that we're dealing with systemic injustices. So you and I, I'm sure you know that systemic injustices can take years and years to deal with, or structural injustices. So I think what's really great about our approach is that we're trying to get to the root of the injustice. You know, put aside the fluff. Why is it that people are unable to, you know, enjoy, you know, right to education or right to health? Why are people still not being given the citizenship rights or access to land? Really get to the crux of the matter. So it's quite, you know, the way I defined it, it looks like, you know, oh, it's so wonderful. Look at this theory. No law, use law, shape law. Sounds nice. But it's a lot of work. It takes years and years.
Yeah, and the systemic injustices, you know, are a factor of just, I mean, are a feature of just about every country. I saw an interesting piece in the media earlier this week. There's a group that's going to court in British Columbia suing the government on behalf of single mothers because they have they're unable to access legal aid. So in their context, to access legal aid, you have to have a certain level of income, etc. So kind of pushing out people who would need the legal aid the most, but can't access it because of the barriers and consequently have, you know, women and girls who've gone through traumatic experiences, they're caught. And in the process, they are unable to, they essentially get, how do you say, re-traumatized, because, you know, they end up maybe having to represent themselves or some ridiculous scenario like that. And the piece talked about the very real, not just likelihood, but the actual events of women who end up on the wrong side of opposing counsel.
Yeah.
With some very aggressive, you know, cross-examination. That really puts them back, you know, in a place where they're unable to heal. And the whole problem would have been better addressed if there was a proper, you know, access to justice, at least a better framework, a more accessible, form of that whole legal aid mechanism.
Actually, you're quite right, especially when it comes to, you know, women and kind of the things that they go through to access justice. I think we can all agree on this Twitter space that, you know, there are continued persisting inequalities between men and women, gender bias and stereotypes that result in unequal access of women and men to justice. So, for example, look at our criminal justice system. You know, how one enters the system and how they are taken through the system is such a disempowering process, Mushiri. I don't know if you've ever worked with, you know, I have worked with victims of sexual and gender-based violence. It's, I mean, already what you've gone through is quite horrific. So at the point where this violation happens to you, okay, fine, then you get the courage. Okay, let me go. You've already overcome a certain type of stereotype. Okay, you've said, okay, fine, I've gotten the confidence, let me report this matter. When you go to the police station, and this is quite real, when it was during the 2007-2008 post-election violence, when women went to report that, listen, my house has been burnt, my property has been stolen, and I have been raped. And the policeman would ask you at the desk, can you choose one thing for me to report? Me, I can't write all those things you're telling me.
Yeah.
And she's put in a position to having to choose that. Okay, fine. Then we have a scenario where there's some who go past that, but past that, you know, stereotype at the police desk. Granted, things are improving these days, but this is just, you know, what still happens in some parts of the country. And so when you enter into the criminal process, first of all, the language that is being used is foreign to you. And by foreign, I mean, you and I, Mushiri, who are not litigants, we're not advocates, we don't go to court. But you understand the kind of language and legalese they use can also, you know, just fly past your head. And then the corporate process itself is quite disempowering. You have a lawyer who is speaking on your behalf. You don't speak. You don't know what's happening. You're just following the lawyer wherever the lawyer goes. And then you have to, you know, retell and recount your story quite a number of times. And this is quite re-traumatizing. It's not an empowering process at all. It's not fun. And it takes long. It takes years, Mushiri, you know. And throughout all this process, you find that, you know, the criminal justice process has no provision for women who are going to court to have, you know, some sort of counseling, some sort of psychosocial support. So in the cases that at least civil society organizations have been involved in, and some of the cases that I have been directly involved in, we try to make the process as empowering as possible. Explain to the victims or survivors, this is what's happening. We are able to maybe facilitate your transport to come to the court. If it's very difficult for you to access the courts, or, you know, provide linkages with psychosocial support so that even if she has to recount her story, it's not too traumatizing for her. And it's, in the end, you know, you're looking for meaningful and effective justice. And so it is my hope personally, you know, this pathway to justice reforms itself so that it's an empowering process and somebody doesn't feel wasted through it all.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've been using the term access to justice quite a bit.
Yeah.
So maybe just for those who are not in this side of civil society and human rights, maybe you can define that for us. You know, what is this access to justice that we're talking about?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good place to start. So for me, who's worked in this access to justice space for 14 years. For me, how I look at it, it's an ecosystem or a context, you know, that supports one not just a privileged few to meaningfully and effectively prevent, identify, and resolve disputes or seek recourse for a violation. So we, everybody should be able to access, you know, what they feel is justice for them if they face a dispute or a violation. But, you know, Mushiri, the current setup we have in many countries, even including our countries, it doesn't allow the ordinary mwananchi or the ordinary citizen to access justice. These are logistical question, you know. How, like, for example, how do I leave my home and access the courts, right? If I'm in a far-flung area like Turkana, I once did some projects in Turkana. So at that time when I was doing the project in Turkana, the High Court was just in Lodwar. And somebody's in Kalokol. I don't know if you're familiar with the terrain in Turkana. It's not a joke. So I leave Kalokol to go all the way to, you know, Lodwar to access the High Court. It just doesn't make sense, you know. And even if you are, if you have a serious injustice or violation, then you're put between a rock and a hard place. Do I just continue living or do I pursue this justice? And I'm not even sure what the outcome is going to be. And then there's also the accessibility of lawyers, unfortunately, or maybe that's just how the system is designed, that most of the lawyers are in the big towns. They're not inside, you know, interior in the villages. So that's another challenge. And then I've spoken about the language in courts and the processes of the courts. And also just drawing again from experience I had in working with the community in committee or the state guests in committee, you find like a lot of people who are there don't really know why they were arrested. So this guy is arrested, he's panicking, he doesn't know the law, so he's presented before a magistrate or he's presented before the judge. He finds some quack of a guy along the courts, along the corridors of the court, and they tell him, you just plead guilty and then I'll help you afterwards. You plead guilty, committee, done, you know? So that's another problem, you know, knowledge of the law and accessibility of the law. And then, you know, within the context of wider pressing socioeconomic needs, then you're always put in a position to choose, like, go through this justice route, where I have to pay a lawyer and all of these costs, or do I just, you know, sit with this problem of mine, sit in this injustice and violation and let, you know, life go on. So the ecosystem, unfortunately, doesn't really support us to thrive to access this justice.
Yeah, so meaning that a lot of those who were left behind continue to be left behind.
Absolutely.
And those who are empowered can access infrastructure, legal services, etc. And continue to be even more empowered.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you know, this question of empowered, people who are empowered and are able to access. There's one thing, you can know the law. You can know, hey, no, this violation is serious, may want to go to court. But then you're also faced with different barriers, like, okay, the court is far, do you have the money to go? Or do you have the money to access a lawyer? You know, you can know the law, you can know that what is happening to me is wrong, but you just don't have, the ecosystem doesn't support you to access that justice. I think in this country, if you have money, then you're the one who's going to access justice.
In which case, then, money is the real empower.
Just say that.
Not knowledge.
Yeah.
You talk about the ecosystem in terms of access to justice, and there's this idea, this approach around alternative justice systems. How does that actually work in terms of expanding access to justice? And you know, what's your experience? What's your view on the whole alternative justice systems approach?
First of all, I'll just say I'm really passionate about alternative justice systems because for me, I've seen it work in certain specific cases that I'll share with you. But I think for us to move along with this alternative justice system together, maybe we have a bit of history. So, you know, there was a study done in 2007 by the Governance, Justice, Law and Order sector, it's called GJ Laws, that found that confidence in the judiciary remained low. So people were not going to court. The fact that people are not going to court doesn't mean there are no conflicts happening. So the big question is, where are people going to resolve their disputes? Where are they going? Are they just staying with their issues? And then also, you know, taking us back to at that time, of this country's history in 2007, 2008, where there was post-election violence. And what if you look at the literature around analyzing the violence at that time, one of the root causes of that open violence was that people did not feel that they would get justice if they went to the courts to challenge certain electoral outcomes. Yes.
That's true.
Sorry, yeah. So now you remember like what happened to Matiba, you remember what happened to Mwai Kibaki, it was a sham. So people didn't have any confidence in the court. Mm-hmm. Then on top of that, in 2017, there was a survey by the judiciary together with the Hague Institute for Innovation of Law, and they found that only 10% of Kenyans use the formal justice system to resolve their disputes. The question was still lingering, Bushiri. Where are people going? And then, where are they going? People are using informal forums, which we collectively will call, for purposes of this conversation, alternative justice systems. So this is where people go to access justice. You can go to the church. They go to churches, council of elders. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, that's good, because I was going to ask you.
Hello?
Which of those?
Hello?
Which of one second? Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you.
So you can hear me?
Better.
Yeah. I was asking which of those alternatives seem to be most popular? Any idea which and why?
Okay, I'll say it's a broad range. I would say it depends where you are. So you know, if in Northeastern, in Mandera, for example, or if in Meru, the Council of Elders. It's quite important, and that's where people go. Upper Nairobi, Kijijini, you know, people go to the chief. Sometimes we'll go to Nyumba Kumi. Sometimes we'll go to the churches. Sometimes we'll go to mosques. People go to whatever forum will be able to address that dispute of theirs in a way that they can connect and relate to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we call alternative justice systems. And, you know, there is a task force that was put together by Dr. William Mutunga to look into these alternative justice systems. And then from that task force, there was a policy. So the judiciary right now is currently implementing a policy around AJS because they realize we have this formal justice system. It's good, but it exists within an ecosystem where there's informal justice system. So how can we coexist and how can we have linkages? So from the formal to the informal. So that is what I think the judiciary is working on right now. And I must use this opportunity to plug the work that we're doing under the Open Government Partnership Platform under the Justice Commitment. So in our previous National Action Plan, and I think it's currently still being implemented, one of the key things we're looking at is how there can be increased funding for implementing alternative justice systems. And, you know, supporting legal aid more broadly for people. And this thing, Kenya, I'm really proud of our country in this sense, in that we are one of the few countries in the world globally, that has formalized its traditional and other informal mechanisms used in accessing justice. So I think we are steps ahead in this. And through the OGP platform, I hope we'll be able to realize, you know, meaningful impact of AJS mechanisms. So if you talk about my personal experience around AJS, it's back to 2007, 2008. There is a post-election crisis, a lot of violations that have taken place. And then, you know, the ICC cases collapsed. And then access to the high courts, for the reasons I've said before, were just very limiting. And some of the cases that were coming to my attention did not meet the criminal threshold for you to go to court. In the first place, you know, some of the disputes were like, oh, you know, this person stole my cow, you know, this person just came, took advantage of the violence and took my pots and pans, you know. So how do you address such issues? There are conflicts, there are serious conflicts for the communities that are affected. So we use the AJS mechanism, and it was very, very empowering and eye-opening for me, who, you know, believes in human rights and let's go to court, sue the hell out of that person. But when I sat down with these victims and the offenders, you know, and we designed a way in which victims and offenders can come together, understand where the conflict came from, agree on something and on an agreement, because people were signing an agreement. I mean, I saw changes not sounding too flowery right before my eyes, how people were reconciling and neighbors were hugging each other. It's not something you only see in the criminal in a formal justice system. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's that approach that even changes how we relate to each other and it's tied to our cultural values, you know, as African communities. Granted, not all cases can go through an alternative justice system, but there's power in using that kind of restorative justice in ensuring, you know, our connections as humans still remains. You'll know that if you go to court, it's very adversarial. Huh? It's me against you, unless it wins at the end.
Those cases you mentioned, you know, things that are not suitable for the AJS, things that you definitely don't want to mm-hmm. have dealt with using an alternative justice system, like pedophilia, you know, things that
rape.
You know, because we unfortunately, I think we have seen communities attempting to use alternative justice systems to deal with you know, defilement cases where, you know, the defiler, the perpetrator is essentially fined a number of cows and told, okay, so this child is now your wife. Now go forth and prosper.
You
know, so I imagine that those kinds of cases, especially those that, you know, have clear criminal factors, then, you know, those tend to be pushed through the more formal justice system.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something that the judiciary is quite aware of and the task force was quite aware of. Because, you know, one of the things they set out to do in the policy is, you know, define the criteria of the kind of cases that can come before an AJS platform. You know, we're quite there. Let me tell you, even murder cases are solved through AJS in some areas in this country. Rape, defilement, solved through AJS. We know that is in contravention of the constitution. So, you know, this policy is trying to streamline, you know, the approaches that AJS mechanisms use and what kind of cases can be brought and what kind of cases cannot absolutely be brought before them.
No, I mean, in this kind of a scenario where you have a formal justice system with formal structures, with a pathway that is defined, you know, this is how you start your case, this is what happens after that, you know, there will be a mention, there will be a hearing, there will be a deposition, there will be X, Y, you know, it's like it has known features. And then you have alternative justice systems, which take the shape or form of whichever, you know, socio-cultural influences that are present in that area. I'm wondering how do you move forward on the conversation of improving access to justice, where improving access to justice automatically assumes that, you know, there is a way that we measured and we have data that says we're not doing well and we need to do this much more, this much better, you know, to get to our threshold. How do you measure this? You know, where do you get the data on something like access to justice in this context?
Oh, okay, that's tough. That's a tough question. I think because we have a plethora, we have a plethora of these AJS mechanisms. You know, like for example, Mushiri, I'm sure in your home state, in the village, there's an elder or you yourself. Let me promote you to that status of elder.
Oh, thank you.
You have maybe resolved cases. You have probably resolved conflicts within the conflict or comfort of your house. No one is coming to ask you to record that data and tell us how did you record the data? How did it work for you? So that's one of the challenges that we're facing, that some of these AJS mechanisms are so personal and so intimate that even accessing that data might be difficult. But that's not to say it's impossible. I think we can start. Where we can start is we can map out what's been done already. I think Council of Elders, like the Njirin Cheke, have, you know, done quite some work, and I think they have some quite some documentation about the cases that they have been doing. And so we see what kind of documentation we have. And, you know, this question of data is, even in engaging these mechanisms, wherever they are, at the chief, Nyumbakumi, we need to select maybe a pilot where we're going to start, maybe a few Council of Elders here, or maybe a few Nyumbakumi initiatives here and there, and create, first of all, start from data 101. Why are we collecting this data and why is it important? And then we need to know who is collecting it, where is it stored, and how is it being collected. All this is participatory data collection. so that they don't feel like subjects, like, oh, I'm doing this work and I'm giving you this information. They understand why I'm collecting the data and why it's important. And also, we want to see how to systematize and how to, you know, the data that is collected. And then what we do with this data has to be very tangible, Mishiri. You know, us civil society organizations have been accused, and rightfully so, of collecting data and then we disappear. What are you doing with people's data? You know? So if we're very clear on what we're doing with this data, we want to link it to resource allocation. We want to tell the government that you need to put in more more funding to this alternative justice mechanism, or we want to be able to have systemic change because we've noticed a pattern in some kind of violations that are taking place. So my point is, let's start small, but we start anyway. And even getting more concrete is something called small data. Some people have written about something called small data. And small data is drawn from the experience of the user, and so the person who goes before the alternative justice mechanism. So you get this data from that person, and it offers an accessible way to understand and address specific problems. So what this includes is getting the individual case data gathered by the alternative justice mechanism serving the poor and marginalized communities, because it draws on the problems faced by real people. Then you collect and analyze this data, and then you're able to identify the problems that matter to that community. So in this way, you're also able to shape the best ways to address those problems, and it can also help us assess the actual impact of a certain alternative justice mechanism and the solution that they propose. Also, which is very important, is that this small data we're collecting from this one people and we're putting it together, it can give us the information to persuade governments and private funders to invest in the provision of community-based justice systems by demonstrating how a low-cost solution can save money and sometimes prevent a costly crisis. And you know, when we're collecting this data, it's less expensive in my view. It's less expensive because it's generated through the day-to-day interactions with the AGS mechanisms. So you're not bringing in a special team of data collectors. No, it's there as it's happening. Collect that data, and it adds also. When you collect this data, these are complete picture. It reflects the experiences of somebody who accesses data through these informal justice processes. It shows what they go through, and you know, such lessons can then be replicated or adapted according to other contexts. So I think that's the way to go. Small data. Let's focus on the user to begin with, and then pilot, and then build up lessons learned.
Taking a participatory kind of approach.
Participatory, please.
And so just for those of us who are not from Kenya, and you've had the term Nyumba Kumi, it's a Swahili word. It means 10 homes, 10 homesteads, 10 houses, I think, more literally. Amy, maybe you could explain what Nyumba Kumi is in the way that it's done here.
Yeah, in the way that I understand, and it's not misrepresented.
Yes.
So Nyumba Kumi was an initiative of the state to respond to increasing security incidences that were happening in the villages or happening, you know, in the towns. So what would happen is that they tried to bring in together households in an affected area to come together and address the security issues and see what they can do. And they then, those households are a link between what's happening in that community and the security agents. So, I mean, it worked well in some areas. It hasn't worked well in some areas. But the thing is, it's a structure that still stays in some communities, and it is a structure that is recognized by both the community and the state. And it is this structure where people go to seek redress for some of the violations that they're facing.
Yeah, so and every cluster of households has an official leader of the cluster, you know, your Nyumba Kumi leader. So that interface, I think maybe the other thing about Nyumba Kumi, I think was also supposed to promote better neighborliness. Know your neighbor.
Yes.
was a very
know your neighbor, exactly.
Factor around it. I think Nyumba Kumi, when I think about it now, it had a lot of aimed at a lot of targets. From security to good neighborhood.
It was Yes, it did. You know, it was against the backdrop of increased terror attacks in the country, if you remember.
Yes, I remember
And
now.
anchored within this, I think, Security Laws and Amendments Act. And of course, it was challenged on you can't over securitize, if that's the word, communities. So, but the structures still remain, and the fact is, some people still access these structures to resolve the conflicts.
You'd mentioned the issue of financing a little earlier. Maybe I'd like to come back to that more for just a bit. I think in the recent past, there've been lots of conversations. I know the GJ Laws program in Kenya that you talked about, the justice, governance, justice, law and order sector reform, something I'm sure it has a bigger name. Part of that was not just about institutional strengthening, but also resourcing the sector, both on the law enforcement side and on the judiciary side. So I think at some point it was possible to tell, whether there's been an increase in spending, what the state of financing is, especially from domestic resources, looks like. But now, because you're within the OGP, the Open Government Partnership, at least on the national platform side, Namati and our partners are leading on the access to justice commitment. What's your take in terms of how we've moved, how we are transitioning away from just a singular form of or approach to access to justice to looking at this really what now seems like a blended approach? What does financing then now look like? For improving access to justice, given the context of alternative systems, etc.
Mushiri, let me tell you, this financing question is a particular pain point for me personally, and I think also for the sector. More can and should be done when it comes to financing. A lot of this access to justice work is, a lot of it is done by NGOs. I've just told you how we were, supporting victims to access justice, doing kind of like outreach to, the committee and the prisoner community, and educating them about their laws. And the thing with CSOs, you can only do as much because you know how the donor ecosystem works. This year you have funding, next year you don't have funding. And even if we have so much funding, like there's an abundance, we don't have the reach and the resources that a state does. So I think for me, the way I look at it is the state cannot abdicate. We can partner, but the state can't abdicate. So I think the state should do more. I feel like justice sometimes is treated like it doesn't appear like it's important. And I don't know if this is an outcome of how we have siloed justice and separated it from the development agenda of the country, or we're just looking at justice as that other thing. I really don't know. I'm just trying to wrap my head around it. So, earlier this year, through the OGP platform and together with actors within the justice cluster, we were able to prepare a petition, and we were making a case for the state to increase financing for justice. And the thing we found out is that there's a trend for the past 5 financial years, which negative, which means that there's a, I mean, for the past 5 years, there's been a continued trend of inadequate budgetary allocations by the state towards justice. So you
This
find
is
that, for
justice more
example,
broadly,
under state law.
justice system, legal aid, everything.
Yes. In fact, I'm even breaking it down. Like you find, so our focus was on the state law office. Under the state law office, we have the National Legal Aid Service. Now, the National Legal Aid Service is exactly what the name is supposed to do. Empower people, educate people, provide legal aid. And then the judiciary, of course, it does what the judiciary does, but also the AJS policy, which is even much more accessible than the formal court, sits within the judiciary. So when you have a trend where the judiciary and the state law office have been chronically underfunded, then what does that tell you about the status of access to justice? We have done in terms of data, for example. So the argument would be, oh, you guys, you need to come up with data. You need to tell the state how this is important for development. We have. in the petition we have, there's a very brilliant study that has been done by ICJ recently looking at the cost-benefit analysis of legal aid. So what it's saying is that, let me just make reference to it, is that the average daily cost of maintaining a prisoner is about Kenya shillings 500. And so for the estimated 25,000 prisoners on remand, this translates to daily expenditures of around 12.5 million or 0.158 billion annually. Or sorry, 15.8 billion annually. That's how much the state is losing when we are not able to fund justice systems properly. So look at these guys mostly in pretrial detention. I already told you, when I was working with the prisoners in committee, a good majority of them is because of ignorance of the law. They can't afford a lawyer. They didn't even know what was supposed to happen. They would not have got to remand. They would not be incarcerated. So if the government was to intervene at that point, in partnership with civil society organizations, they would not be losing this amount of money. And this is a study that's out there. So even for us as the cluster, what we said is we were now giving even the qualitative aspect of it, how access to, and we had evidence of how access to justice improves livelihoods, strengthens the delivery of essential services, addresses the root cause of conflict, reduces inequality, all of that promotes citizen engagement. And we have cases in court. We have actions that have been done in various parts of the countries that adds to this evidence. So, you know, the promise, you know, of one being able to access justice is compelling, yet the challenge of financing hinders this important work. So for me, where I sit when I've been trying to grapple my head around this is that we've spoken, we've said we have the data, we've been able to demonstrate, we've done studies. For me, the person is now Ushiri, is the problem the source of the data? Do people have a problem with data generated by civil society organizations? Okay, fine. If their methodology is not quite what maybe government has endorsed or what government does, how can we work together with maybe Kenya National Bureau of Statistics, systematize how we collect data, and then now make use of this data that really lies with a lot of civil society organizations? So I think a lot of discussion needs to take place and more collaboration needs to happen on how we use this data.
How much of the data that you use for the to establish the trend on financing, how much of that was open data in terms of, you know, you went to a website and found it, or did you have to do the old school thing, you know, knock on a few doors, call in a few favors, buy someone coffee?
No. We actually were able to go to the website of Treasury, and but there's a big but. It's not very easy to navigate. We had our friends from the Budgetary Institute. I think it's PPI, Budgetary Allocations Institute. I forget. It's very, very useful. This is a
Parliamentary Budget
NGO. Yeah. They're part of the OGP platform. I'll remember them. And this is what happened. We were trying to access this data. And we couldn't access this data. So we reached out to some folks within OGP space. And then one of them, Steph Mushai, she said, oh, I know this guy. He works on budgetary allocations. He can help you. So he's the one who directed us to National Treasury website and told us how to navigate. So even if the data is out there, you still need somebody to help you navigate. And even if the data is out there, not many people know that the data is out there. So there's one thing about data being open, but there's another thing about awareness and accessibility of the data. So for us to establish that for 5 years has been chronic underfunding of the judiciary, we went to National Treasury and we were able to compare numbers and we were able to, you know, do further analysis of the allocation. So that was quite helpful. I'll say that.
How is Namati and its partners, how are you guys doing on publishing that data, opening up that data, other than the, I know it currently within the petition, but have you now curated that data in combination with your own data and published that as well? Is it available?
Yeah, so what we did, it's available if you're in this space. We combined our data as civil society organizations from our casework, from our advocacy work, and then also combined it with the information that we have from National Treasury to make even a bigger case for increased financing. We even presented this petition itself to National Treasury. So, you know, the thing with civil society initiatives, sometimes I find that we talk a lot to each other. So if you're in Access to Justice, you will know where to find this information. But if you're just, you know, walking on the streets, minding your own business, you wouldn't know where to find this information. So I guess also it's a question for us, even as civil society, how we make our own data accessible to the local Mwananchi or the local citizen who would benefit from this information.
Yeah, you know, getting better at opening up our own data, essentially, right?
That's true.
Earlier on, we talked about, you know, just going back to the story from British Columbia with the group, the single mothers who are suing the state because of, you know, difficulty in accessing legal aid. And then you mentioned some of your own observations from here, and I'm just wondering, in your view, you know, from where you sit, how well is our justice system serving women and girls at the moment? Looking at Kenya's case, because you know you work in Kenya.
It could be better, Michelle. It could be better. Mm-hmm. I think we still have a long way to go. The patriarchy. The structural injustices that just keep women further and further behind is what's really getting in the way. You know, I'd like to draw from the COVID-19 pandemic and the strict lockdowns that we're experiencing in parts of the country and also the continent, you know. And GBV, I mean, intimate partner violence and domestic violence came to be known as a shadow pandemic. Mm-hmm. This is when states now came to fully realize what we have been saying all along, that women and girls need protection. Gender-based violence is an issue. It's a crisis, you know? And so with the data that we were able to show, like in many places like South Africa, in Kenya, in Uganda, there was a statement at the level of the AU around this shadow pandemic. Then, unfortunately or unfortunately, because of COVID, some of the countries like Uganda and South Africa were able to pass policies around the protection of women and GBV policies that have been sitting on the shelf for years, despite us saying, let's have this conversation, this is an issue, these are the case studies. It took COVID for some states to act. Hopefully we don't have another pandemic for states to be jolted into action and for us to be continue making meaningful steps towards, you know, supporting the journey justice of women and girls. Realize that women and girls are operating within a context of patriarchy and systemic injustices that are working against them. And so the barriers that women and girls face are greater than what men would face in trying to access justice. And this is a part of the conversation that we're still trying to have with policymakers. Granted, if you look at the Kenya space, we have something like the gender-based we have a GBV desk, a gender desk at police stations. So what the gender desk is meant to, you know, encourage women to go and report, women and girls to go and report what's happening to them. There's always the question of, you know, financing. Have staff been trained still on the gender desk? There's some places where the gender desk is working well, some places where the gender desk still needs some work. So a lot of the data that we've used in pursuing, you know, better rights for women and girls and accessing justice, we've used it for advocacy, we've used it to have better justice responses and design, you know, interventions like the gender desk that I've spoken about. But it still brings me to this question. I think as civil society, we try and learn. We are collecting the data. We are doing advocacy. We are collecting stories. Mm-hmm. We try and meet with policymakers as much as we can, but we are still not connecting. There's a language, we're not speaking the same language. I think, for me, if you ask me, honestly, Mushiri, policymakers know there's a problem. They know there's a problem. They know they have to do something about it. But it's just that now translating it into action where we're just not connecting. And I would love to have, you know, these honest conversations about what's not happening. Mm-hmm. What are we not doing better? Are we not collaborating better? Is our data not good enough? I'd just like to have this conversation. Other than that, I think we still have a very long way to go in terms of making the justice systems more responsive to the specific needs of women and girls.
Yeah, I think later in the year, I don't know if actually I forgot that there's one happening this year. I know the some of the AU meetings tend to be biennial, but we have this African symposium on that happens. It's a meeting of the statisticians across Africa. It's a very important meeting because they meet to discuss new programs, aligning on methodology, etc. For instance, they've coordinated with each other across the continent for a number of years around computer-assisted surveys and censuses, right? And they learn from each other. So I mentioned this because one of the things that has happened in the recent past is this idea around empowering non-state actors to collect citizen-generated data in a way that passes muster, so that it can be used within the statistical system. And I think part of that includes a quality assurance mechanism kind of built in. And I imagine that the national statistics offices around Africa, like Kenya's Bureau of Statistics, we'll probably build in some kind of a capacity building program, to kind of help the non-state actors who, for the most part, are not statisticians, do not employ statisticians, but are doing these innovative things around citizen-generated data, using technology, etc. And I'm just wondering if that might present an opportunity to do exactly what you're talking about, have a platform to have that conversation with the government, with the NSO, and say, hey, we have all this data, but you seem to not be interested in using it. Maybe we can get it, you can help us get it right, or get it better. Mm-hmm. And then possibly that might be one of the channels available to bring some of this data into the national statistics system. It seems as if once this kind of data becomes part of the NSS, it's quality assured. It's likely that it becomes officialized by the NSO as official statistics, and possibly that could help drive uptake, use, especially by those working on policy, and are traditionally nervous about quoting data that they might be called out on.
No, I agree with that approach. Absolutely. I think we had already started kind of that initiative in Kenya where we're trying to, what do we do with this citizen generated data? How do we collaborate better with the Kenya National Bureau of Statistics, ensure that the data meets, the threshold? And then from that point, see now if we can really, really now influence how financing flows towards justice. I think as a sector, we're open to that. We are open to that kind of collaboration, and there needs to be a lot of concerted efforts around this. What I think is remarkable is that there's this opportunity for us to work with the statisticians and, kind of bring our heads together and see what we can do in terms of directing financing where it's really needed, and also, linking, and also what the statistics will be able to do, will be able to now show in a way that government understands the cost of injustice to the economy. The statistics will show the numbers, the cost of injustice to the economy, and maybe that way we'll be able to, jolt the state into much more concrete action.
That's true. Amina, you mentioned Mary wants to say something, so maybe we can bring you up on stage, and you can introduce yourself and pose your question or comment, and be as brief as possible. Mary Salim?
Hello, Mary. I've sent you an invite to speak.
Okay, Mary, you have the, I think, the prompt to open up your mic, if you want to say something. There you go.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Mary Salim from the Local Development Research Institute. I just wanted to ask regarding the informal justice approach. What if someone is not satisfied with the ruling or decision that is given about by the person giving the ruling? What is their next course of action? As well as you mentioned that most of these informal approaches are outside of big towns. What is there a database or a public source of information that contains those ones that are in big towns or cities? And yeah, thank you for your work. You do amazing work. Thank you.
Amy, that's a question for you. You know, the elders' decision has been refused. What happens? And then I think maybe because I know we didn't touch on this, the issue of arbitration in terms of the formal arbitration system, because I imagine that there might be a clearer database for that. But yeah, so maybe you could give your 2 cents on these things that Mary's raising.
That's a great question. I'll give you from my personal experience in working with AGS mechanisms, is that we would try to bring people together and have a set of recommend, having listened to both sides, and the adjudicators would try and, you know, recommend a way forward. So for example, if you stole my calf and it has been 7 years and it has become a cow, you have to compensate me for those 7 years. And when they refuse, and if I refuse that recommendation, which I am free to do so, it is signed and recorded. At least that's what we were doing. And then now we were pushing it forward to now the formal legal system. And then now saying, okay, if at this level, as adjudicators or as elders, we're unable to solve this issue, then we will forward it to the formal court system and let's see what kind of legal advice we can get from there. That was one way of trying to, you know, address that situation. Another way we were trying to do is we were trying to bring the judges or the magistrates to come in the actual sitting and listen in and perhaps, you know, give their views as well on how the case is proceeding, or also give maybe some recommendations on the conflict that has come. So we were just trying different ways of trying to solve that conflict. Most of the time people agreed, but we left that provision open that if you're not satisfied, then your way of appealing is to maybe go to the courts. But it was different in different cases. I think in certain communities, they said one way of appealing would be now take it to another forum of Council of Elders, and where that fails, now you take it now to the formal justice system. So it depends context by context.
Right. So arbitration vis-a-vis alternative justice.
Well, arbitration is still within the formal justice system. Yes, it's still very formal. I think it's still very lawyer-led. You know, happens right, you know, where the lawyers are, and still in a language that the person participating might not be able to fully understand. I don't find it an empowering process at all. It does solve the justice problem. Let me just make it clear. It does solve the justice question. It is a way of ensuring, you know, that the court is not backlogged with certain cases, and it's a useful tool. But if you're looking at how alternative justice systems work and the people-centeredness around it and how it is implemented, then you see that there's a stark difference.
Absolutely. It's still it's lawyer led, and sometimes it's lawyer driven. You know, top to bottom, the arbiter, that one, you know, can sometimes tend to be a lawyer. Is a lawyer as well, isn't it?
Or a trained arbiter. Yeah. It's very formal, you know.
All right. No. Thank you. Thank you so much, Amy. Have there been any questions that have come up, Amina, that you think we could address in a couple of minutes?
No.
Nothing caught your mind? Nothing caught your attention?
Yes.
All right. No, well, th- thank you so much. Thank you so much, Amy. This has been quite fascinating. We have it. This is our first Twitter space on the other side of Kenya's general election. An interesting time to be here and to be watching litigation unfold. Kenya's first female chief justice, presiding over some of this. We have the largest number of female governors ever. We only have three. We're only on our third round of administrations now. We're starting our third round. But still, you know, we seem to be making progress somewhere, probably not as fast as we should. And the quality of the progress, I think, still needs to be explored and unpacked. But I think it's an interesting time to be here and to be watching all of these things unfold.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we should give credit where it's due and give a shout out to the country, you know, for being resilient and pushing through, you know, a justice agenda, pushing through, you know, a gender justice agenda. And I think we're on the right track.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I think we shall leave it there for this edition of the Twitter space. We just give you all a bit of a heads up. We are part of the team working on updating the State of Open Data report, which was initially published in 2018. A lot has happened over the last four years in various thematic areas. So we're going back to revisit some of those chapters and have a little content added in there by some authors. One of those is on crime and justice. So there will be an updated chapter on that. We'd hoped the author would be with us today, but unfortunately, the scheduling just didn't work. So do keep a lookout for yet another conversation on access to related to access to justice coming up in a few weeks, and an update to the State of Open Data chapter on crime and justice, which was originally done, you know, almost 4 years ago. I think that's the only other plug I have. Amina? Oh, no, before Amina, Amy, do you have any other Namati plug? It's plugging time.
Yeah, of course, I have a big shout out to Namati. If you're not following Namati, please follow us at Namati Kenya or at Namati Global. We have lots of, you know, interesting discussions that we hold, online webinars. Please follow some of our work, get to know and interact with some of our methodology. And we have this wonderful thing on the interwebs called the Legal Empowerment Network. And this is where we have the largest online community of grassroots justice advocates come together to learn, to exchange using this online platform. We would love if you joined us and help us make law as democratized as possible. Thank you.
Excellent. More democratized law. Amina, anything you want to plug? Any announcements? Any song? Do you have a song?
I don't have a song, but I'll just like to invite everyone to follow our pages at LDRI Africa and also our website at developlocal.org. We have interesting events lined up from the month of September. Yeah, on data for development.
Excellent. And of course, please do follow the Data for Development Network, d4d.net. Amina, you can read out the Twitter handle. I'm not good at remembering Twitter handles offhand. But we look forward to seeing you on the interwebs over the next few weeks as we unpack a whole lot more of these conversations that we've been having. So Amina, what's the Twitter handle for D4D? If you could just say it out loud.
Yes, it's at d4d.net.
D4D.net. Excellent. All right. Thank you, everyone. Enjoy whatever is left of your day and have yourself a fantastic, fantastic weekend. Bye-bye.